and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm Carol Van Dam in Washington. Here are some of the top stories making news across South Sudan, Sudan, and the rest of the region this Tuesday, April 18th, 2024. Some South Sudanese women say the country's deteriorating economy is having the biggest impact on them.
My husband is a soldier in SPLA, but his salary does not come regularly. If he gets 1 month's salary, he spends several other months before receiving the next salary.
And energizing Africa, what will it take to accelerate access?
You cannot be using the budget to finance shortfalls of about 1.9 billion. And that's just about 2% of GDP. And that is so much. And this is why we have been pursuing a number of reforms to bring the energy sector to financial sustainability.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. South Sudanese women say they bear the brunt of the country's economic hardships. A Juba woman who crushes stone for a living says the survival of her family rests on her shoulders since her husband has not received his salary in months. Munyang David Mayer reports for VOA from Juba.
...45-year-old Margaret Joro is busy crushing stones in Juba. Joro says the money she earns from selling these stones to customers to use in building homes will pay for the bread she buys to feed her family and fees to send her children to school.
My husband is a soldier in SPLA, but his salary does not come regularly. If he gets 1 month's salary, he spends several other months before receiving the next salary. And we women have become the breadwinners in the family. From here, I get sometimes 10,000 South Sudanese pound, sometimes 15,000 South Sudanese pound. And when I make a lot, I get up to 20,000 South Sudanese pound.
South Sudan has been hit by soaring inflation in recent weeks after the country canceled crude oil sales for February and March. That made the South Sudan pound to fall again against major foreign currencies, which makes the price of imported food and goods climb. Sandy Karama, another Juba resident, says South Sudanese women bear the brunt of the country's economic hardships and it can lead to problems in their homes. She says her husband often quarrels with her when she prevents him from spending money on things like cigarettes.
My husband is not working. I am the one who goes around to look for something for our children to eat. Sometimes my husband asks me for money, but I refuse to give him money for cigarettes because of the condition we are in. At least when he is sick and wants some money to buy medicine, I can give him. But things like alcohol and cigarettes, I don't give him. And usually he gets annoyed and talks negatively, but I remain quiet.
Karama says South Sudan economic troubles have forced many families, including her own, to focus on food and food alone. Ayen Chol, who works in a Juba tea shop, says taking care of children has become the sole responsibility of women in the country.
I come to a place like this to help support my children. The economic situation in the country has really worsened with the rise of the dollar rate. There is nothing you can buy with 10,000 South Sudanese pound in the market. Now, the work I am doing here is not enough to support the feeding of my children. Sometimes they spend a night without any food.
South Sudan's finance minister, Awo Daniel, says his office is working to address the country's deteriorating economy. In an Easter message to the nation, President Salva Kiir said he directed his economic team to find remedies to address inflation, but details of those solutions have not been released. For VOA News, I'm Anyang David Mayer in Juba.
At the World Bank IMF spring meetings now underway here in Washington, panelists at a roundtable discussion yesterday tackled the complicated issue of how to energize Africa and what it will take to accelerate access and improve lives. Akinwumi Adesina, president of the African Development Bank Group, says a big focus of the spring meetings is on figuring out ways to electrify Africa.
We've got to look at the number that's staring us in the face as 600 million people, and we say that's not acceptable, and walk our way backwards. And so what we agreed is, if you take, for example, the African Development Bank, in 2016, when after I was elected first time, I said we're going to light up and power Africa. We set up something called a New Deal for the development of energy in Africa, which is to have universal access to electricity in Africa by 2025.
Right.
Well, we had to be bold. We had to take it on because the situation was so embarrassing anyway. And so we knew it was a long stretch, but well, look, we're going to go for it. And we did, working with everybody globally. What happened was we were able to take the electricity access rate in Africa from roughly 32% to 57%. So 25% increase. This is massive for Africa. We were able to do that. And what we did at African Development Bank is that we put in $8.9 billion into that. And that allowed us to have 22 million people connected to electricity. Okay. However, I'm sitting next to Ajay, my friend, and I'm saying they're asking us to think big, bolder, and better. And so to be able to do that, I couldn't be asking for a better partnership than with Ajay right here in the World Bank.
That is Akinwumi Adesina, president of the African Development Bank. He was referring there to Ajay Banga, president of the World Bank Group. Banga says hundreds of millions of Africans still do not have access to electricity, and that's got to change.
600 million people in the continent do not have access to any power. Any. Zero. And to me, that's an unacceptable situation in the year 2024. I think electricity is a human right. I think electricity is the basis by which people can get access to health, people can get access to education, people can get access to the ability to innovate and manufacture and build productivity. If you don't have education, you don't have health, you don't have productivity, you don't have jobs, there is no solution to poverty and growth and development. And so to me, getting electricity to people is mission one, two, and three.
Mohamed Amin Adam, Minister of Finance in Ghana, was asked during the discussion how Ghana can bring down its high subsidies on electricity, which are considered unsustainable by many experts.
You cannot be using the budget to finance shortfalls of about 1.9 billion. And that's just about 2% of GDP. And that is so much. And this is why we have been pursuing a number of reforms to bring the energy sector to financial sustainability. For example, we have been implementing what we call the Energy Sector Recovery Program since 2019, which is intended to bring the sector to financial sustainability. There's a task force chaired by the Vice President, which is overseeing the implementation of the various reforms and the measures that we are implementing to strengthen the finances of the sector include IPP renegotiation. We are renegotiating some of the contracts we've signed with the independent power producers so that we can reduce the cost of generation, particularly capacity-related cost. We also are implementing tariff reforms.
That was Mohamed Amin Adam. He's Ghana's Minister of Finance, and he was speaking at yesterday's panel discussion about Africa energy on the sidelines of the IMF World Bank spring meetings this week here in Washington. A Kenyan military helicopter crashed a little while ago in western Kenya. At least five people on board are reported to have died, and three have survived. So far, Kenyan and international news media have not identified those who were on the aircraft, but Kenyan news outlets are now reporting they included some very senior military officers. We'll have updates as they become available on voaafrica.com. In the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo, specifically in the Beni and Butembo regions, parents are finding it hard to get vaccines for their children. Healthcare providers report that vaccines have been in short supply for several months now, leaving thousands of children unvaccinated. Parents fear their children's healthcare are going to be on the decline and are calling on the authorities to quickly resolve the situation. Zanem Nedi Zaidi reports from Goma.
In the town of Butembo, vaccination programs have come to a stop. The head nurse of the Makasi Health Area, Kambale Wangahikia, confirms the absence of vaccines in certain areas of North Kivu province. He says they are missing several vaccines, such as the one that fights pneumonia and helps children fight coughs, and also the vaccine that fights meningitis and mumps. He says that all children born and unborn are therefore still at risk. This situation creates frustrations for breastfeeding women. One mother, Kasoki, is worried because her infant son has not yet received the BCG vaccine against tuberculosis. She says she has a four-month-old baby, but he's having trouble getting BCG and other vaccines. She went to the hospital four times and couldn't find anything. The doctors gave her several appointments, but when she arrived, she could hardly find anything. She's worried that her baby will catch serious diseases. Another mother, Stephanie, says she made several trips to health facilities to have her children vaccinated. It was only last week, she says, that her son received his first dose of vaccine. She tells us about the fear she felt. She says she felt very bad because the vaccine she had been looking for a long time was very important for her child, because if he didn't get it, he would be exposed to disabilities and diseases when he grew up. She says that the health authorities should force themselves to bring in the vaccines, because this shortage could cause problems for the children later on. Kasoki Defros, a nurse at Beni's University Clinic, says that not vaccinating children has consequences for the physical health of newborns. She says that local authorities are working hard to respond to this shortage. She says that if children aren't vaccinated against polio, for example, they risk becoming weak and their muscles won't be strengthened. She says the authorities intend to respond to the shortage soon. According to officials from the Beni Health Zone, which oversees dozens of hospitals in the region, over 1,000 children are waiting to be vaccinated in several towns in the Beni and Butembo region. Zanem Nchizaidi, VOA News, Goma, in the Democratic Republic of Congo.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. Coming up on South Sudan in Focus, conservative European lawmakers gather for a meeting on what they call preserving the nation state in Europe. Stay tuned.
Hello, listener of South Sudan in Focus. We have an exciting new segment dubbed Words of Wisdom. We want to hear your thoughtful proverbs that echo through your community. This is another chance for you to share wisdom from your roots. All you need to do is record a proverb in a language of your choice, tell us its English translation and what it means. Keep it brief, authentic, and represent your community. Your recorded proverb shall be sampled on South Sudan in Focus every Wednesday. Send your recording via our WhatsApp number, +1 202 630 8011. That is +1 202 630 8011.
A gold mine in Zimbabwe has turned its former dump site into a solar station, generating all the energy it needs for operations at the mine and releasing excess energy into the national grid. Located in Zimbabwe's southwestern Bubi district, some 500 kilometers from the capital, the project has drawn praise from environmentalists. Columbus Mavunga has more.
After losing hours and hours of production due to Zimbabwe's chronic power shortages, the Tech Gold Mine decided to take action. Workers removed 1.5 million tons of mining waste from a dump site and erected a solar power station that generates 4.4 megawatts of electricity per hour. Taurai Danda is the mine's environmental manager.
The installation of that plant on a former dam site was a strategic plan to say we have to save the environment, we have to avoid cutting into new virgin land. So we opted for a former dam site, which we had rehabilitated. Since then, the generation from the solar plant is able to run the plant, every equipment, every asset that we have on the mine, and with excess, that power is thrown into the national grid.
Danda says the new dam site, unlike the previous one, does not release contaminated waste into a nearby river. Instead, the solid waste is kept in the dam site while water is recycled for use at the mine. Chipompo Fuzuze, who heads the environmental management agents in this southwest region of Zimbabwe, says other mines should emulate the Tech mine, which despite its name is owned primarily by Canadians.
They removed waste, the tailings, to a new site which is properly engineered to protect underground water contamination. And what we also appreciate is they didn't open an old, a new virgin land to site their solar field. They've also saved the forest. What we also appreciate again is they've gone green. Instead of relying on thermal power or hydropower, we know the impact on the environment.
Tech mine and government scientists say the solar project spread across 3.6 hectares of land will save 5.4 million kilograms per year in coal for thermal energy, or 116.8 million liters of water for hydropower. It's not only environmental scientists welcoming the project. 23-year-old Precious Piri, a mother of one, is one of the locals employed to clear the solar panels of dust from a nearby road and lime mining operation. Piri says, my life has changed financially. I'm now able to pay for my children's fees, buy uniforms, and I'm able to do whatever he wants in life. As a mother, I'm able to do these things. Zimbabwe's power utility says that with the global calls for green energy to reduce emissions, the Tech Mine solar project is commendable, especially in Zimbabwe, where energy shortages are worsening due to droughts in the region. Columbus Mavunga, VOA News, Bobi, Zimbabwe.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. Right-wing politicians, academics, and campaigners from across Europe gathered in Brussels this week for a two-day national conservatism conference that organizers said was aimed at preserving the nation-state in Europe. As Henry Ridgewell reports, an effort by the Brussels mayor to shut down the conference prompted accusations of an assault on the right to free speech.
The foremost figures in European right-wing politics gathered for the National Conservatism Conference in Brussels this week, among them Nigel Farage, the architect of Britain's exit from the European Union, and Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban. In their sights were the familiar foes, the European Union and immigration. Orban spoke at the conference Wednesday.
If somebody would like to make an attempt to create a mixed society, Christian-based with Muslim communities, and as liberals think, the outcome will be something good, let's do it. It's your fate, it's your future, but don't force us to do so.
Orban criticized Western support for Ukraine in its fight against Russian invaders.
Without getting the money and the weapons from the European Union and United States, Ukraine as a state would cease to exist. So it's not a sovereign state anymore.
Orban has become the figurehead of the European right, analyst Georgios Samaras says.
Because he's highly successful in pushing an authoritarian practice, an authoritarian regime in his own country, I believe that the far right right now is trying to use the same playbook.
The conference billed itself as a meeting of like-minded conservatives to preserve the nation-state in Europe ahead of European Parliament elections scheduled in June. Again, Georgios Samaras of King's College London.
This is the consolidation of different manifestos into one.
But the meeting nearly didn't go ahead. Police blocked access to the venue Tuesday after the mayor of Brussels issued an order to shut down the conference, citing public security concerns. An emergency court ruling overturned the mayor's order. Participants said his actions were an example of what they labelled left-wing cancel culture. Among them was former member of the European Parliament and campaigner for Britain's EU exit, Nigel Farage.
We can see that legally held opinions from people who are going to win national elections is no longer acceptable here in Brussels, the home of globalism. Because if you don't agree with ever closer union, you must be a bad dude.
Polls suggest centre-right and far-right parties are set to gain seats at the June European elections. A recent EU survey suggests that Russia's invasion of Ukraine and European defence and security are high on the list of voter priorities. Henry Ridgewell, VOA News, London.
The Secretary General has received the resignation letter of his special representative for Libya and head of the United Nations support mission in Libya, Abu Dale Bethely, which he has accepted. Bethely said the situation in Libya had deteriorated significantly in recent months and cited two reasons: the lack of political will and good faith on the part of Libya's main actors, along with what he called the new international and regional dynamics. He emphasized that Libya has become a battlefield for external actors and warned it has been on the verge of losing its sovereignty. Ambassador David Mack, former Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for the Near East, discussed this development with VOA senior analyst Mohammed El-Shenawi.
Well, unfortunately, the competition between different geographic factions in Libya has overwhelmed the Libyan people's overall interest in having new elections to establish a credible Libyan government that would have authority from all the way from its boundary with Tunisia and Algeria to its boundary with Egypt and its southern boundaries with countries like Niger. And it's the United Nations, supported by the United States and for the most part by the countries of Western Europe, has steadfastly tried to help pull the Libyan factions together. This would be at a time when it's a great opportunity for Libya and some certain other countries like Algeria to build their market share in Western Europe for oil and gas. Because right now, with the problems in the Red Sea and with the continued delays in getting the Iraqi pipeline through Turkey to the Eastern Mediterranean moving again, the oil prices in the Mediterranean region are extremely high. You would think it's a tremendous opportunity for Libya. And I have recently talked to senior Libyan officials who want to see this happen. But the political factions are preventing it from coming together. They're competing for what they can obtain in the way of Libyan oil revenues. And I think it's a sad fact that the central institutions in Libya have been too weak to influence the political leaders to come together. It's a great opportunity, and Mr. Bathily, the head of the UN mission, along with the United States and other countries, have been pushing for elections so that there can be a new credible government, and it just hasn't gelled. And it's an example, I'm afraid, of the lack of political will on the part of senior Libyan leaders on the ground.
So does Russia have any role in obstructing a political agreement that would produce a unified Libyan government through elections?
Khalifa Haftar, who was at one time supported by the Central Intelligence Agency, that was a long time ago, he is now operating very closely with the Russian government and what's left of the Wagner group of mercenaries. And they have considerable influence over what he does. There's a huge interest for NATO to make this work. And President Biden is very much committed to the idea of Libyan elections. But we have not had the influence we used to have with Libyan factions. There is discussions going on behind the scenes to reopen our embassy in Libya. Some European countries have already done this, but it's a risky business given the current security situation in Libya.
So what do the United Nations do now after so many failing attempts by its envoys in Libya?
Well, I think the United Nations is going to have to find a new envoy for the Secretary General, somebody that could have the diplomatic skill to represent the at least the Western nations in the United Nations in trying to reestablish some kind of unity among the different Libyan political factions.
That was Ambassador David Mack, former Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for the Near East, speaking with my colleague Mohammed El-Shenawi. And that wraps it up for this Thursday. We invite you to check out voaafrica.com for all your favorite programs and news updates. If you somehow missed this broadcast, just head on over to www.voaafrica.com/South Sudan. We now leave you with the song We Want Peace by South Sudanese superstar Emmanuel Jal.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today.
Do you know any first aid techniques?
Come to think of this question, I thought I do, but seriously, I think I may not be able to do too well if there is any situation present. Maybe it's something I need to go in and learn how to do. It could help somebody tomorrow.
During our school days, the Red Cross Society, the clubs that we joined, they taught us a lot. When a child runs high temperature, you sponge the child with water from the leg to the head. Then you just rush the person to the hospital for best treatment.
In case if you have drowned maybe from water, the first aid technique that is available to be given is a kiss of life to a person that has drawn into water.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I'm looking for some people who's looking for peace. Maybe together we could make the war cease. Now we can send mankind to the moon. And we can reach to the bottom of the sea. That's why it really kind of baffles me that we cannot end wars and bring peace. And we cannot change the way people act. And we cannot change the way people think. So if we sit back, chill out and relax, civilization will soon be extinct. That's why I am. I'm calling on.
We've been listening to We Want Peace by Emmanuel Jal. I'm your host, Carol Van Damme, in Washington. On behalf of our engineer, Phil Andrade, and producer, Kwame Afori, thanks for listening and tuning in. We'll see you back here tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.